everybody. Matt Geary for the Geek Pride cast on this Monday evening. With me tonight, as always, we have my co-host, Peter Ray Allison.
Good evening, everyone.
And we have not one, but two special guests this evening. We have a familiar face and a new guy here to talk about The Father of Dracula, which is a new book, I believe, gentlemen?
Film, documentary.
New documentary coming out shortly. We have John West. And joining us again, Dacre Stoker.
Hi, guys. Great to be back.
Right. So, gentlemen, for those who obviously have been living under a rock or don't know who you are, can you tell us a little bit about yourselves?
Yeah, I'll jump right in. I'm Dacre Stoker. I'm fortunate to have been born into just the right family for this genre. I am the great-grandnephew of Bram Stoker, author of Dracula. So Bram was one of seven children. His youngest brother, George, was my great-grandfather. And that's how I've sort of come into this whole game. For the past 15 years, I've got very involved in my interest, which is digging up research, things that have been found before, things that have not been found, and putting them all together in a logical sequence so I can let people better understand my great-granduncle Bram Stoker. He never wrote an autobiography. So everything that we have learned from him and what I'm currently putting together with John West, who you'll hear from a moment, and Jason Figgis for Father of Dracula documentary, is all bits and pieces scattered around the world, literally, and brought together in a way that's never been done before. So great to be here and glad to chat all about our project. It's just on Indiegogo right now as a crowdfunding platform.
John,
who are you really doing? I'm John West, born in North London, as you can tell from the accent. And I'm a filmmaker, film producer. I've done acting. I write books. I've got three books out on British ghost stories. I write for a magazine called Psychic News, ghost stories for them, which has been going since the 1930s. I used to be a DJ on the radio as well, and I'm an historian too. So someone once called me Renaissance man, so I'll take that.
Say, many feathers to the proverbial cap.
Yeah, I'm an all-round great guy, let's just say that. And I got kicked in the head by a Bond girl once, so that's another story.
How did you, John, how did you and Dacre Stoker meet exactly? I mean, it's, you live in completely different countries, if not continents. How did you come together?
Well, it was Jason Figgis, the director I work with, who's based in Dublin, and he knew Dacre way, way back. And Jason came up with the idea to do a documentary called Father of Dracula. It's not The Father of Dracula, it's Father of Dracula. And he contacted me as a writer and said, would you be willing to write it? And I did say, well, I must admit, I only know the basics about Bram Stoker and Dracula. You know, for instance, I'd read sort of like Dan Farson's book many years ago, the children's one that he did that had Dracula in it. And he said, well, I know Dacre Stoker. And obviously I was aware of Dacre because I'd seen his books and everything and seen him in a couple of documentaries on Dracula in the past on YouTube and whatever. And he put him in touch with me and Dacre together. And we started chatting and Dacre sent over a research material. And I basically wrote a narration for it. I also got some material from various other books and did online research. And I even watched a couple of documentaries presented by Christopher Lee and Vincent Price. So actually they played a part in this too. So they should get a credit at the end of the film then. So that's how we came together. And we met, didn't we, Dacre, a few years ago. Well, it was in Great Yarmouth. It was a sci-fi thing, wasn't it? After Jason first introduced us, and I met you up there, and I interviewed you, didn't I, for the radio station? I
was that's actually the one where Peter Ray Allison was at the sci-fi weekend in Great Yarmouth.
All right,
sci-fi weekend. They're bringing people together once.
Oh,
again.
Oh wow! I did not know that. That is a small world. I mean, you talk about meccas of science fiction. Great Yarmouth is now becoming the mecca of science fiction for the UK. The connections that kind of seem to kind of synchronize there. I mean, like, take it for yourself. I mean, how long have you been researching Dracula for?
Well, it was, probably started about 2003, lightly. when I started getting involved in the first book that I co-authored with Ian Holt, Dracula the Undead. And I didn't know much about my family at all. I did know some about Bram's youngest brother, but that was the impetus. You know, someone says, do you want to get involved in writing a story? But I need someone from the Stoker family who knows a lot about the family, because I'd like to have Bram in the novel as a character. So, you know, that wasn't really my forte. I was a physical education science teacher. I had coached at the Olympic level, but I did not want to let someone else screw it up. And I didn't want someone to write misinformation, because I get so tired of these other biographies. And John and I've had these discussions. Some of them get parts of it right, but many of them get kind of tricked into adding sensationalism to sell the book or sell the documentary. So they add all kinds of fluffy stuff. And most of it, you know, is some of it circumstantial, but based on nothing. And I decided, can I get to the bottom of this? And that started, you know, about a 15-year mission. And along the way, as I find these really interesting things, I break off and stop researching, and then we'll write with a co-author and put all that stuff into play. And that's how the production has sort of happened, with taking, you know, getting out Dracula the Undead, and then Dracul, and then Stoker on Stoker, and then these lectures and things. But this project is near and dear to my heart, because I feel that working with Jason and John, it's time we got out not just a factual, but an accurate documentary that, you know, people will look at and enjoy and remember. Because look, we all know people love books, but they really love to look at things on their phone or on their tablet or in the theater or on their television. That is sort of the mecca, as you say, Peter, as far as entertainment goes.
Yeah, and one thing, it's like, I mean, you said like you were previously a, you know, coach, like, you know, for the Olympic level. That was a massive shift from going from coaching into research and writing.
In a way, yes, because there was less, you know, blood and sweat and running and shooting and fencing and riding horses. But there was still a very similar amount of preparation, disappointment, and sometimes euphoria. You know, you sometimes have great days when it comes to sport, and sometimes not so great days. And the same thing happens when you're writing. You get, you know, knocked back by either a bad review or you find a dead end. And then you got to pull your socks up and get back at it and keep going. And so, you know, part of my athletic career, both as an athlete and then a coach, has sort of prepared me for these things, to say, look, put in the work, keep, you know, there's no shortcuts when it comes to research. I'm sure John will tell you the same thing when it comes to all the research he's done in Roman history and ghosts and so on. You've got to be the one that finds the most accurate information and then use your creativity to present it to the public in the best way that you think you can get best results. But finding all the right things, the journals, the letters, you know, what other people have said about Bram, and cross-referencing them to make sure that they're right, not just sensational, that's the job. And it's really quite simple, Pete, to the teaching and to the coaching as well.
Yeah, one thing, I mean, I'd say for me as a writer myself, is the hardest part I find is when to stop researching. Of course, you could just keep going and going and going. How did you kind of rein yourselves in, John and Baker, kind of, rather than kind of going as deep as you can, to kind of, no, we have to kind of pull back a bit here. How do you kind of rein yourselves in?
Well, I'll let John start with that, because, you know, I was the one that gave him all this stuff and he did a really good job. And also, why don't you pick up this, John, with, you know, you really were that one that had the final word on the scope of the project. I just kept feeding you stuff.
Yeah, well, basically, I mean, Dacre sent me a load of research material, so I sort of collated that and sort of lifted, you know, the information that I felt was needed. And, you know, I don't think we had any disagreements, did we, about sort of information and stuff? I don't recall any. But, and I also sort of went online myself, checked original documents, and I did read other books on Dracula and on Bram Stoker and, you know, things like that, and watched a couple of documentaries as well. And, I mean, you've obviously, at some point, you've got to call a halt to the research, because otherwise you'd never stop. But it's always crucial to go back to the original material because it's, you know, as a writer, I write books on ghosts, as I said. You can have stuff on a particular haunting and you'll just find often that writers just lift material from the previous writer. And if that writer's made a mistake, they're just repeating his mistakes. And I've often gone back to the original source material for instance, on Bawley Rectory and things like that. And like a writer's published it in inaccuracy and it's been repeated and repeated. So by going back to the source material, I've realized, God, you know, that's not correct. So going back to the original source material is essential. And I mean, for instance, Dan Farson, who was also a descendant of Bram, he made a lot of errors and assumptions in his book. And although it's a great book and I enjoyed reading it, and he did start some rumours about Bram, sort of like the bisexuality story, which I basically dismissed because there's no evidence for that. But unfortunately, because that he started that ball rolling, it's now accepted as fact by a lot of people, which is not correct. You know, we can't prove that he didn't have feelings for Henry Irving and that, but I think it's highly doubtful. And it is a bit annoying when it's sort of published as a fact. Well, Bram Stoker was bisexual or homosexual and he didn't love his wife and she didn't love him. And, you know, and it's all basically based on one author's feelings and interpretations based on no evidence really whatsoever.
Well, you get a lot.
And if I may add, when we had some very interesting conversations, John and I, about that. And what I was able to add when John cast a shadow of doubt over this sort of allegation was that luckily what I've got at my disposal is Bram Stoker's two great grandsons. Now they're in their early 80s. Their minds are still just fine, but they were actually raised by Bram's son, Noel, their grandfather. So Bram had a son. Noel had a daughter. Daughter Anne was married twice during World War II. Both husbands died during the war.
Oh.
But during the process, three boys were produced from two different husbands. One of those is no longer living, and two of these half-brothers still live. So I could go to these two gentlemen, my cousins. They've got still very good memories of what Bram's son told them about his father. And one of the things that has been passed down in this chain that I just explained is that Dan Farson was from the branch of Bram's younger brother, Tom. Tom was married, had a daughter. That daughter was married and had Dan Farson. So the name Stoker is gone, but he's still a grandnephew. Mm-hmm. So there, unfortunately, was a lot of resentment during Dan Farson's mother's life and Florence, Bram's widow. She still led a very comfortable life. Her fame as a result of Bram's writing and the books being turned into stage plays and into film. You see, Bram died in 1912, so he was long gone but when all this happened. But Florence lived a very comfortable life because Bram left those film rights and the dramatic rights, and she capitalized on them, so she had a lot of money to live on. And apparently that creates some resentment within the family, and that's where this sort of tension, as John just described, making up a sort of half-truths or no truths, but they just certainly proliferate because he was the first member of the family that wrote things like this. So that's how things get started, and that's some of the things that John and I had to look at and say, well, let's be the ones that set the record straight in this. And it was a great pleasure because he was a guy who's done a lot of research on his own for certain books and knows exactly what that can lead you to if you don't get the facts right from the beginning.
Yeah, that's one of my sort of my pet peeves about history is we did a module when I did my military history degree. It was called "It's Not the Truth, It's What You Believe," and it's basically this view that there's so much in history that people believe is the truth, but there's no factual basis behind it whatsoever, and it's just things people have accepted over time because that's what they've been told, and as time's gone on, it's just a thing that they've sort of accepted. And I have this sort of kind of pet peeve about people like I'm a part of a Sharp, you know, the Sharp the novels and Sharp the TV series Facebook group, and they were banging on because some French guardsmen were tripping at Buckingham Palace, and somebody sort of started going on about cheese eating surrender monkeys and stuff, and I was just like, got really annoyed, because there's this sort of thing about, you know, this sort of fake history about the French and what they've done over the years, especially during World War II. And I was just like, if it wasn't for the French, the BEF would have been absolutely destroyed during Dunkirk. If it wasn't for this, and it just annoys me that people have this sort of, they just accept what they're told and they don't sort of look into it and they don't sort of do a bit more depth. And
the critical analysis, basically.
Critical analysis, yeah. It's just like they're happy to watch these fast food things that you get on Netflix and just accept it as the truth, or, you know, watch Braveheart and go, well, that's exactly what happened, and not sort of kind of put any sort of thought into it. And that's like fast food learning. It's just like, well, the TV told me that's how it was and that's how it is. And It annoys me. It really annoys me. And I spend a lot of time keyboard worrying to people. It's kind of saying, well, in fact, you'll find that, blah, 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 because it annoys me so much. So I understand fully. It really winds me up that people just believe what they're spoon fed instead of.
So Father Jacques seems to be kind of almost like dispelling the myths that have kind of surrounded Bram Stoker and kind of given a true representation of his character.
That's exactly what we're trying to do. But at the same time, you want to make it entertaining.
Yeah.
You know, you want to keep it enjoyable rather than just, you know, super fact checking. That could be pretty dull. But you know, that's John's forte. Is like, I may give him the situation. Here you go, John. How are you going to handle it? And he comes out, you know, with a great script.
So how do you get that sort of balance between factual accuracy and entertainment? So you see sort of things like, I'm sure you've probably seen some of the history doc. I say history very lightly on say Netflix, and they're very dramatized, they're very entertaining, but historically they're very questionable. How do you get that balance?
Is that for me or
that's for you? Yeah.
I mean, obviously you've got to make it entertaining. If it's as Carlyle used to say, you know, dry as dust history, you know, it's not good to read because it's boring. So you know, my writing style has always been sort of very sort of informative, but you know, I've thrown a little bit of humor with things and stuff. So I just wrote it for people who I knew would be interested in Dracula and Bram Stoker, but I didn't want to write it as a sort of academic work which would put people off. So I mean, I mentioned Kermit the Frog, you know, biting the neck of Vincent Price, you know, and sort of, you know, Sesame Street and things like that, and you know, and Christopher Lee sort of sexualizing the Count and making him this sexy figure, because you know, I'm surprised at the amount of women I've asked, you know, about Dracula, actors who played him, and they, you know, who do you think was the sexiest one? And some say Frank Langella, but most of them say, oh God, Christopher Lee could bite my neck anytime. and when you watch him as an adult, you actually realise, yeah, he did really sort of, that changed the character, because Bela Lugosi is very suave in that, but I wouldn't have said that his sort of character was sort of sexual, but sort of Christopher Lee's definitely was, and you could tell that the women were sort of begging him to bite their necks. So, but what you were saying about history and sort of shows and that, yeah, I do get frustrated when I see stuff about, I mean, I'm a great admirer of the Emperor Napoleon.
Right. Oh, have you watched it then? The travesty.
I watched it and sorry, Ridley Scott, but I could write a whole chapter on the inaccuracies of that film.
The 95th Rifleman with a scope.
Yeah, it's entertainment, but there were just things that were in there that, you know, never happened. And, you know, you come away really not knowing Napoleon, in my opinion. I mean, I think Rod Steiger in Waterloo, and I know he's sometimes accused of overacting, but I think he played Napoleon really well in that film, and Napoleon was putting on weight and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, these dramas and that, like the Tudors, I mean, it was a great series, but I mean, Henry VIII wasn't a slim, good-looking bloke.
Yeah.
Like the one they got to play him. I'm a student of the English Civil War and Oliver Cromwell, and you know, I mean, the Cromwell film with Richard Harris was great, but it was totally inaccurate. And people sadly watch that and think, God, I didn't know Cromwell did this and did that. And history is written by the victors as well, and history is often distorted for political reasons.
Of course.
And we're now in an age where, sadly, history is being rewritten to sort of accommodate political trends, shall we say, and, you know, what how they want people to think and that. And if you're going to tear up history and presenting it in a way it wasn't actually, how it didn't happen, you know, how it was, you know, it's just ridiculous, in my humble opinion. So, sorry, Ridley Scott. It was still an entertaining film, but, yes, yeah, what could I say?
I promise, Dicker, we'll go back to Dracula, but we'll have to briefly talk about Napoleon, because I watched that film wanting it, like, really, having being brought up with the Waterloo film and loving it, and just, like, Napoleonic history. I did my, not a great dissertation on Napoleon, but sort of, I grew up with Napoleonic history. I loved it. You know, like I said, Sharp, you know, grew up with the novels and reading the books. So it was my thing, and I came out, and I was just like, I was forcing myself to want to love this film, and I couldn't. I didn't mind, like, I have to say, I didn't mind how they portrayed Napoleon, in that I found him quite, I quite liked the Josephine Napoleon dynamic. I quite liked that she was very, it was a really, it was a bit of a car crash relationship, but it was like, it was real. It felt real, and I think they'd focus more on that, but they just kept on jumping around and adding in, like, the Battle of Austerlitz was an absolute travesty. It was just like they had none of the main sort of parts about, you know, taking the heights, the Pratzen Heights and stuff. They sort of mentioned, oh, get onto the heights. It's like, you're on a flat field, and the only thing, it all it seemed to do was about the cannons. All they were obsessing about Napoleon was he was an artilleryman, so we'll have cannons in every single shot we can, and then sort of kind of focus on that. And I was just like, oh man, you're just killing it. And Waterloo was an absolute, the field works in Waterloo, and the fact that that rifleman had a scope on his rifle, and the fact that when the guard advanced on the British line, or even when the British, who were in apparently entrenched positions, and then moved forward from those entrenched positions and formed square, I was like, what are you doing? Why would you do that? And it was just like, I was like, okay, I'm done now. I can't deal with this anymore.
And also, I should say, he didn't fire cannon at the pyramids, and he didn't lead a cavalry charge at Borodino.
Yeah, Borodino. Yeah. Just like.
And he was wearing a uniform that wasn't from that time.
Yeah.
So,
I get sort of.
Scott's never going to want to work with me after this, is he?
I get sort of being a bit, you know, bombastic now and again. I there's no doubt historical things that I watch and don't know a lot about history and go, oh, that was good, because I'm not thinking about the history behind it. But it was just like the Napoleon Josephine stuff was interesting. It was good, and it's, for me, I felt like he had this sort of kind of weakness to him, which was good, and he was kind of slightly, I want to say, autistic in a way. Like, he had that sort of spectrum thing going on, which I quite like, because I think that felt like maybe what his character would be. He was sort of a military genius, but with that genius there was obviously underlying things, and I just, the battles just really did not do it. It was just horrendous. It was just
so
like,
as a character study, it worked fine, but as an actual historical representation,
there was too much going on. They missed out some major things. Obviously, didn't do the Battle of Leipzig. They didn't do any of the sort of, like, you know, the defeats and stuff. I didn't like how they portrayed Wellington. There was lots of things that, had they done a series, because it was an Apple Plus thing, had they done a series and they'd maybe focus, and they'd call it Napoleon and Josephine, and it was just about their sort of, you know, unhealthy relationship with each other, and then interspersed it with some things like that, I think that would have worked quite well. But they tried to throw in everything in like 3 hours, and I won't watch it again.
And also, don't forget, Wellington met Napoleon on the Bellerophon.
Oh, yeah.
He didn't.
Yeah, apparently so.
And I thought, hold on a minute, this never happened. I love the scene at the end when he's on the chair and then he suddenly bumped. I mean, was that supposed to be him dying? He died in bed. Sorry, Dacre, we've gone off a bit off topic.
No, listen, I watched the movie just 2 weeks ago, and I'm really enjoying to hear your guys' take on it, because I was always confused, because I didn't know much about the history, about how much was accurate. And as Matt said, it was more a film about the relationship between Napoleon and Josephine. Now, I don't even know if that was realistic, but it was entertaining.
Yeah, I think the letters and stuff were pretty bang on. And she, you know, was basically sleeping around when he was away and stuff. And he was really obsessed with her. So I liked that whole thing. I kind of liked the comedy side too. I think I kind of liked that he was a bit clumsy and certain things. And I liked that sort of, he was a bit odd. That I liked. It was just that they jammed too much together in a short period of time. The battles were literally just, let's cavalry charge, let's throw the cannonballs everywhere and stuff. There was no sort of like nods to the actual history behind those battles or anything. Like the invasion of Russia, which, you know, we lost, what, he sent 600,000 men in and, you know, 50,000 came back. And there was no... There was no real sort of, you know, that was a massive blow. It was just like, you know, it was just a thing. It just happened and that was it. And
that was his downfall, wasn't it? I mean, invading Russia finished him. And the ironic thing is that Adolf Hitler attacked Russia on exactly the same day, the 22nd of June. So that should have been a bad omen.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, Russia finished him. I mean, he went in with a massive army dominating Europe and it broke him. I mean, he could have won against Russia if he'd perhaps had a campaign over two seasons, but he tried to do it all in one year and he didn't provide for his men for winter, so it was a disaster. I mean, you said about Josephine and Napoleon. I think they got it slightly right with the relationship, but I think they missed a lot of it. I mean, Napoleon was deeply in love with her at the start and was devoted to her, and she did cheat on him, and when he found out, it was never the same again. But after... she thought, God, he's going to dump me. She then actually really fell in love with him and was devoted to him for the rest of her life. Yeah. I know some historians might deny that, but I feel that it sort of woke her up and she suddenly realized, God, you know, I do love this man. But of course, he left her for, you know, the Austrian.
Yeah, Austrian.
And, but the ironic thing was that Napoleon III, who eventually succeeded him as emperor and got ousted in 1870 after the Franco-Prussian War, was the grandson of Josephine. So he might as well have stayed with Josephine because obviously his son died as a young man and he was only, I think, Napoleon II for a few days, wasn't he?
Here, another little sort of historical tidbit. Napoleon IV was killed by Zulus in the Anglo-Zulu Wars. I was reading an article about it, and it was just like he wanted to take himself off, and he's like, "I wanna do something." And the British are like, "Oh, fuck's sake, we can't have this guy like a descendant of Napoleon getting killed." And so they put him off with some little sort of recce group, you know, just look after this guy, don't let him get into trouble, and ended up in sort of a load of Zulus, and they disemboweled him. And so, he was killed by Zulus in the Anglo-Zulu War.
He was on his horse, and I think the stirrup broke, and he fell off, and his fellow officers left him there.
Yeah.
And his death mask, he was buried in England with his father and his mother, and his death mask is there, and is actually the mark in his eye where the Zulu speared him. Oh, wow. I would do my Michael Caine impression. I don't suppose he said, "Zulu, thousands of
them." We talk about accurate representation. I mean, I have to ask you, what was Bram Stoker really like as a person?
Back on topic, Pete. There you
thank
go.
You very, thank you very much.
Well, if you really want to find out, we got to get people to fund our Indiegogo campaign and let Figgis and Wes do it, because it's about a 90-minute long documentary. But I can give you a couple of teasers.
Yeah.
Just before you do that, so you've talked about the Indiegogo, and I'll just put it on the screen for people who are watching at the minute. So just tell us a little bit about the Indiegogo, and then you can carry on.
Right. So the crowdfunding for this film, we need to raise about, I think it's 30,000 US, 25,000 pounds. 20,000, thanks, for the editing of this whole thing. So we've actually collected all the video already. I've been doing that with some of my friends who have gone with me to Scotland, to Whitby, to Transylvania, to Ireland. Figgis has got a bunch of interviews that I set him up with to find people who, you know, good talking heads for this. So we've already been collecting this stuff out of our own expenses. And then John did the writing, I did the narration. But what we really need is high sophisticated amount of editing to get this done just right. So it's really professional. John, is that a good way to sum up the Indiegogo need?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's basically so Jason can work his magic because he's a great director, editor. He gets great images and he'll just do a fabulous job. And We reveal all in the documentary about what made Bram Stoker tick. We don't want to give too much away because obviously you'll say, well, we don't need to watch it now. But it's very interesting, the stuff that Dacre sent me. And, you know, it dispels a few myths, shall we say. I know we've touched on the homosexuality issue, but there's other myths that we dispel, which we'll have to let the people watch. We don't want to tell them, Dacre, do we, too much?
Well, we won't tell them too much, but I will say this. You know, he made an incredible recovery from his childhood illness. And I won't tell you what my theory is now, but we will talk about what the theory is, what that illness was. So we'll move on from that. But he became a champion athlete and a very diverse athlete, which was really interesting to see a kid go from 7 years old being an invalid to a champion athlete at Trinity 10 years later. But he was also a very conflicted man, and conflicted in the way that of his family, there was three scientists, my great-grandfather being one of them. So three of his brothers became very successful and famous doctors. One civil servant and the two sisters were very successful as artists. Bram had this sort of, I think, a split brain, a split mind. He was very detail-oriented in many things. He was a clerk of petty sessions in the legal department of Dublin Castle. He became the inspector of all clerks all over Ireland, which required somebody to be very detail-oriented, very law-abiding, you know, attention to detail. But he also had a really dramatic and a much more sort of, you know, side of him that is, you know, involved in the arts. He was a founding member of the Dublin Painting and Sketching Club. He loved to write poetry. I found his journal that he kept while he was a student at university that showed me the beginnings of his writing. The absolute first dated piece of writing he'd ever done was in Greystones, just outside of Dublin. And he was describing night fishing. So here was a young man, head of the Philosophical Society, head of the Historical Society, all around athlete, but he was also doing a master's in mathematics. But he loved the theater. So he wrote pro bono literary reviews. So that side of him, that sort of artsy side, the creative side, was sort of, to me, battling and would reach an agreement with the detail-oriented side when he got the great job of his life, which saved him from a life of boredom. It was the theater manager for Henry Irving at the Lyceum Theater. And that's when everything changed. And we'll go into detail. We won't, not here. But that relationship between Henry Irving, the actual theater itself, the roles Irving played, and how that really affected the novel Dracula. But it is a young man that had to come into his own, I think, through confidence building of sport. And then on the debating, sort of debating rooms at Trinity, and then success in different fields as a clerk of petty sessions. And then that gave him the confidence to go on to do managing Henry Irving, the greatest Shakespearean actor of his time. But then secretly he begins to write and express himself. So he's definitely second fiddle to Irving and he's comfortable in that role. But doing this, you know, sort of as anyone who's written a book will tell you, you bear your soul at times, even if it's a historical based fiction. That's what Bram got into, did tremendous amount of research, which we uncover in our documentary. But he puts himself out there almost the same way Irving would on stage and put yourself out there to reviewers. And boy, some of the reviewers were not friendly to Bram Stoker when it came to Dracula and some of his other works because they didn't quite get it. So I think that's probably enough to be said about who was Bram Stoker. A lot more will be revealed in the documentary. And we had a lot of fun sort of striking the balance that Matt asked about earlier between how do you sort of, you know, put enough out there so we get to know Bram, who is the father of Dracula, but what else went into it? What other events in his life? What other things influenced him and his writing of this iconic novel?
Yeah. I mean, my family and I went to Whitby last summer for our holidays. And when I was there, like I reread Dracula, and you can tell the level of detail that Bram Stoker went to in his novels. Like, you can walk around Whitby now and you can trace the steps of the black dog as it leapt off the Demeter and went up into towards Whitby up. You can, and the level he captured it, and it still remains true to this day. So, I mean, phenomenal piece of detail and writing in there.
You know, some people, and I like to throw this out to you guys and the listeners, some people do complain about the novel and say, geez, there's so much unnecessary detail. You know, first of all, if you haven't read it and you've just seen a movie, you got to do yourself a favor and read the book, or at least a synopsis, because it's written in something called the epistolary style, which was very much Bram Stoker himself, letters, journals, diaries, newspaper entries, and so on. Degree of detail was Bram's way of putting it all out there. So the reader would be challenged to read different points of view from different characters, different sources, and come to a conclusion themselves, which is very similar to what Bram was doing as a clerk in the Petty Sessions legal department, or a student at Trinity, the head of the Philosophical or Historical Society, is gather facts, put it together, and interpret it, and then either debate for it or come up with your opinion. So I want to ask the other guys here, Peter and Matt and John, what do you think about that style of the book, but also that degree that Peter's talking about, you know, walking through Whitby the way Lucy had to get from one part of town to the other, and the black dog, and all the addresses and all the legalities of the ship's cargo being held by certain laws. So it could be, you know, if the Coast Guard got it, you know, it would be held back, but no, the Coast Guard didn't get it. So now it's going to be able to go into the trains and go off to London. So what is your thought on that degree? And does it help the story or hurt the story, Peter?
I thought it worked, actually helped it, because it set it in its time, explained to you how that world, I mean, you've got to think about it. Back then, probably people already knew that, but like 150 years later, we don't know how like the different laws and regulations operated at that time. So having it there helped it. It kind of set it in its time and of the place. So for me, it kind of immersed myself in the setting and the story.
Yeah, I don't mind depth. Like, you know, if you've read like Game of Thrones or any of the Song of Ice and Fire books, stuff like that. Blasphemy. Martin basically puts a lot of depth into a lot of things, and I like that. I like that, knowing what's going on. It sort of world builds for me. And like Pete said, if you know, obviously we're not from that time, so you've got this sort of
relation.
Yeah. Of the whole sort of the whole thing, and for me that works really well. It's not for everybody. I can understand some people are like, I just want to get to the good stuff. So I think that's why you get in films and stuff like that, they just knock a lot of that out.
But then there is a word for that. There is a word. We have the word slow burn to describe that kind of encroaching sense of suspense as kind of setting the atmosphere, setting the world, and you know something's coming, but it's not there yet, and you just know what's going to happen. It's building suspense. I mean, it's kind of part of all this streaming thing is people have no patience now. They want to get to the good bits. Well, no.
Yeah, that's cheap coming from you, Peter, because you were going on about something being really long. Was it Lord of the Rings being too long and you couldn't watch it?
Well, it is too long, to be fair. But
it's not too long.
but we were talking about Cobra Kai, because that was just padded out with way too much teen drama, and I'm too old for that.
Oh, that's right. So that's right. We had this argument because you skipped to the very end. You skipped to the end and then watched the last couple of things. So, you know, it just... There you go. Hypocrites. I'm pointing my finger at you. You can't see me, Pete. I'm pointing my finger at you.
Can't see it, Matt. Can't see it.
Hypocrisy.
Anyway.
But well, let me just say this, though. I think, I mean, yeah, I agree with everything you guys have said, but I'm going to add one more thing. Bram was on a quest to make his story seem real.
Mm. Yeah.
So putting all those details in, as minutia as they were, having the count needing to understand the legalities of importing boxes of dirt and how many solicitors you need to do land transactions and move all these things around, All of that stuff is things that Bram Stoker knew as a legal person himself. So he put in what he knew. He had train schedules just right. He had all the layout of Whitby, as you say, just perfect, although he was there only once. He had London laid out just perfect because, of course, he spent 27 years there. So this is a tactic back in the day to sort of have Count Dracula arrive into Whitby and then London and have all these places that were, you know, ultra familiar to everybody. Oh, my God. Maybe there is a degree of truth here.
Yeah, and you have,
and I think, go ahead.
I went to the hotel where Bram stayed.
Yeah, but you have,
and I saw that. Sorry, I didn't go into it because, yeah, I don't have a few thousand pounds with me. But like, so like, yeah, it's a beautiful room.
You had that sort of period of time as well, where the occult and spiritualism and all this other stuff, you know,
occult romanticism,
was rife. So, you know, and sort of, like you said, having that depth and that sort of this dipped in reality, it's like, is it real? Is this what we're reading? And I think having something like, for me, when it comes to horror, stuff that feels real freaks me out a lot more than with horror films, which are just monsters and stuff like that. If it's something that I feel like this could happen, that's the thing that really sort of kind of freaks me out. So I fully agree. I think having that depth and having that sort of like, well, this is what day-to-day mundane things are, yeah, are what brings that sort of, it's like like the tightening of an elastic band. When you have this sort of thing where it's like you feel like there's this tension and it's like you're building up and it's like there's all this stuff's going on and it's building and building and building, and then snap, the thing happens, and that just has that impact on you. It's just like, wow, oh my God. And I think that's what that is. It sort of, it builds it up.
I mean, I would like to sort of, you know, come in on that as well. I mean, the realism always worked for me. I mean, I must admit, I read the novel later in life. I first became aware of Dracula through Bela Lugosi and the Hammer films. So I was only aware of the story through that. But I mean, when I read it, I was very impressed with the realism. And for instance, like the Black Dog in Whitby, I mean, Bram based that on a genuine legend of a ghostly black dog, which supposedly still haunts Whitby to this day. We have in England these legends. We got it in East Anglia. He's called Black Shuck in this area. Now, there's theories that it was brought over with the Vikings, you know, the hellhound of Odin. So, the realism really works for me, and it certainly doesn't bore me. It can come across as a sort of real account, shall we say. So I think it was well written, and, you know, I've got no problem with all the detail. And it's like travelling back in time anyway to sort of, you know, Victorian Whitby, London. And you mentioned the spiritualism aspect. I mean, we cover that in the documentary. And because Bram knew Conan Doyle, who was a, you know, later in life really got into spiritualism, and he was associated with people in Golden Dawn. I know some people claim that Bram was a member of Golden Dawn, but I don't think there's any evidence for that.
What was Golden Dawn, sorry?
It was an occult group in the 19th century, the sort of, you know, the old gods, the old ways and that. I mean, Aleister Crowley was once associated with them, but he fell out with them and fell out with most people, actually. So it's basically an occult society that was founded in the Victorian period because, you know, it was a heyday of spiritualism. And, you know, people were sort of, because of Darwin and, you know, descending from the apes, people were shocked. And, oh, God, you know, so there is no God. So a lot of people turned to that in despair because they thought, you know, what are we if we're just descended from apes? You know, there's got to be more to life.
That's a really interesting point. I've never connected those two dots before, but it makes sense.
I mean, I was aware of a lot of this anyway because of my interest in ghosts and writing for Psychic News. But yeah, so I brought it all in, and Bram was pretty open-minded about the supernatural, as Dave will confirm. He certainly wasn't, a total disbeliever. He was open-minded, as many Victorians were. I know some Victorians went, you know, I mean, Conan Doyle later on perhaps got too involved in it and accepted, like, the Cottingley Fairies story, which were obviously cardboard cutouts. So sometimes he allowed his better judgment to get in the way of things, his lack of judgment, sorry, to get... But, you know, it's a very interesting subject anyway in its own right, spiritualism in Victorian Britain. But it is part of the documentary and Bram's interest in that aspect of sort of Victorian life, the sort of darker side, shall we say.
And what John just said, I've got to back up this because it's really, really little interesting. It's not trivia, but we discovered a newspaper article in Bram's notes that he found in New York City in 1896. And so when I look at that and throw out my research, it's like there is no question that this played a role in his writing of Dracula. And where's my proof? And this is what I presented to John. You guys be the judge. There is a section in that newspaper article that quotes Charles Darwin, who, if you remember, 1859 is when The Origin of the Species came out. So it wasn't too long. 1890 is when Bram started his research, right? So he actually said, Darwin said, when I was in South America on my expedition, we actually found these big bats coming out of the trees and would drink blood from the cattle. Bram took almost those words and put them in Quincy Morris's mouth when Van Helsing was trying to explain to the band of heroes what the heck a vampire was. And Quincy Morris, you know, yes, when I was in South America on our maneuvers, these bats came out of the trees, and one of them drank so much blood from my favorite mare, I had to put her to grass. He had to put her down. So that little piece is Bram taking Charles Darwin, the naturalist who upset the whole world of you know, religion and science altogether, and backed up this whole concept of spiritualism or helped move it along and stuck that in Dracula. That article was all about the New England vampire scare of the late 1800s. That was tuberculosis. In the same way that the other amount of research Bram did was all about the vampire scares in Transylvania in the 15th, 16th century. That was all plague and cholera and so on. So he found gold in that newspaper in New York. And again, we connect those dots much more detailed as John works the magic with that in the script.
There's a lot of jumpy people in New England, you know, witches, vampires.
Oh, I mean, the Salem witch trials is a whole story itself. But not only did they have all those, they had Mercy Brown, Sarah Tillinghast. They had 50 exhumations that were state approved during that 10-year period, which
that's
is all tuberculosis.
Year.
So that's state approved, not crazy people just going and digging up graves. It's state approved in those different states, thinking that that is what we have to do to stop whatever is causing all these people to die. And this is not in the Dark Ages. This was in a period of enlightenment, late 1800s, when they were learned men. But these superstitions, as we all know, take a long time to sort of wash their way out.
Wow.
There's another actual case as well. I think it was the 1970s, and I can remember this as a kid. There was an Eastern European immigrant living in London, and he choked to death on garlic. He was terrified of vampires and was convinced that they were going to get him, and he literally had this garlic in his mouth, and he choked on it and died. So even in the 1970s in Britain, you had people who believed in vampires. And Highgate Cemetery in London, as Dacre will remember himself, you know, in the 70s there was a vampire scare, and you had these self-appointed vampire hunters. Oh, sorry, not the camera then. Vampire hunters going out into the cemetery, and a chap, I can't remember his name now, but he claimed he'd staked a vampire. And that, and I went to Highgate a few years ago with an old girlfriend of mine, and we went round there. And you know, the guide said even today there's people that are convinced that there's some sort of vampire creature in this cemetery, because you've got all the catacombs and that. It's pretty spooky stuff. And apparently you get these giant spiders coming out at night. They're not native to Britain, so how the hell he got over here, I don't know. But she said, oh, well, you know, they only come out at night, but they sometimes come out during the day, I have to admit. And they're only the size of dinner plates, and I was looking at. But yeah, so even now there's sort of people in London who are convinced that there's sort of this vampire-like creature in Highgate Cemetery. And this is, you know, 2024 now. So it's still alive, this tradition of vampirism. And there's still people who actually believe that vampires are reality.
sort of ties in with, obviously, you do writing for what was the name of the
Psychic News magazine.
That's it.
It's the longest running paranormal magazine in the world. It was founded in the 1930s. It's a spiritualist one, but they've sort of had more ghost stories now, UFOs, things like that. So I've been writing for them for about 10 years. And I also have ghost books as well. My latest one's Britain's Haunted Land, which I hope everyone will buy. Jason did the cover. Actually, I've got it over here. I'll just quickly plug it. Might as well.
So
it's a great room.
What's your sort of, do you completely believe in it? Are you semi-skeptical? How's your sort of view on the whole thing?
I have met too many people who have experienced things to dismiss it as a load of rubbish. And I've experienced things myself that I can't explain, including mediums that have told me things that they couldn't possibly know, stuff that's not out there in the public domain, shall we say, but only I knew personally. So I believe there is something, ghosts and that. I don't believe in sort of, you know, vampires going around. I know there's this theory, psychic vampires. And I have met one or two people that drain you. You know, you want to get away from them, almost draining your energy.
It's so like Colin in what they do in the shadows.
Yes, 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 exactly.
An energy vampire.
Yeah.
I've met a couple like that. And I had to literally get away from them. I felt they were drawing my energy. But no, I believe that there is something to ghosts. You know, I believe that, you know, whatever we want to call this energy, a soul, a spirit, lives on. I don't know where it goes, whether it's, you know, heaven or whatever, another dimension. There is definitely something there. So I am a skeptical believer, because I don't accept every ghost story as a reality, as a fact. I always look into things. I mean, for instance, I was once driving along the road and the headlights picked up what to me looked like a black figure, like a monk-like figure, standing by the road. Now, if I'd panicked and turned around and gone the other way, I was a ghost monk on that road in Suffolk, but I carried on. And when I got close, it was just like a bin bag hanging from a tree. But from a certain angle, and with the light, it actually looked like a figure, like a monk.
Well, that's so, there's a whole thing about that, and the human brain, when it can't, if it doesn't understand something, it makes things up so it can sort of fill in the gaps. Darren Brown does a lot of stuff like that, where it's like he'll show you a picture and you think it's a face, but he's like it's like clouds. If you're looking at clouds, your brain doesn't understand
the recognition.
Yeah, so it starts making shapes up to try and recognize it, and it's like a thing when you're a we're cavemen and stuff, and we had to sort of. We couldn't sort of sit there and try and rationalize things. You had to make a decision, like that rustling in the grass is a fucking tiger, or that thing is that. So you had to make these decisions quickly or you would die. And that's where that sort of comes from. So
I agree. I mean, I think that there's different explanations for ghosts. I think some could be just recordings, the stone tape theory. So basically, an emotion, an event is recorded somehow and is replayed back like a DVD. And if you're sensitive to that, you can pick it up. I believe some are probably spirits of the dead that for some reason have come back and been unable to move on. There's other theories that some of them are time slips. They're not really ghosts. It's someone else's time briefly interacting with ours. Obviously, there's hoaxes out there and fakes. So I believe there's something to it, and there's different explanations. Just like with UFOs, I wouldn't say that every UFO is obviously from another solar system. There could be other explanations. I mean, one person's told me they're convinced that UFOs are time travelers from the future coming back.
So. Okay.
How do I know? Could be.
Like I come from in Northern Ireland. We're a place called Redhall. And it's like there's all kinds. We've got a headless horseman. We've got a white lady. We've got all kinds of craziness going on, all kinds of things. So we're growing up as a kid, we had a little club where we'd do UFOs, and we'd go watching for UFOs and ghosts and things like ghost hunting and things like that. And there's a lot to it. And we've had somebody, I can't remember the fella's name, and it's really bad, but he's a astrophysicist, and he was, you know, he does ghost tours and things like that. And I said, so what do you think? I said, like, I don't fully believe. I couldn't be honest and say I used to when I was younger. I don't now. And he says, well, why not? I said, well, you know, you can't prove it and stuff. And he says, like, yeah, but as and he started talking about, you know, you can't prove that they don't exist. And I was like, yeah, that's true. And there's all this other stuff where it's like with the physics behind it and how energy it's never created and it's never destroyed. Therefore, it kind of goes somewhere, and there's this sort of underlying thing behind that as well. So it made me think about it. I can't say I believe, but I'm open to sort of
open-minded.
Yeah, I'm being open-minded. I'll be open-minded, a bit more open-minded than I was about it. The UFOs thing, I'm not sure if they've visited here or not, but I do believe that there, you know, in an infinite universe, there has to be something. There's no way that, you know, we are the only sort of, you know, sentient beings that exist. So, you know, it's possible. I'm happy to sort of accept. If somebody showed me evidence, I'd yeah, brilliant. That's great. But until that point, yeah.
Hey, Matt,
carry on.
I want to throw something out to all of you guys. I found this in Bram's journal, and it was a quote by Yeats.
Oh, I love Yeats.
Okay, you may have heard this before. The world is the world is full of magical things, patiently waiting for our senses to grow sharper.
Oh, wow. Love that. William Butler Yeats is one of my favorite poets. I really, really like him. She dreams for
But I mean it's like Brown collected a lot of quotes, a lot of material, didn't he? You mentioned that, you know, he collected like newspaper clippings. He was an absolute hoarder when it came to information, wasn't he?
He was. I mean, that was that side of him, the very detail oriented side, to collect all this info. All the books that have been discovered in the London Library have given us really insight into his process for doing research and getting pieces. And he literally lifted things about volcanoes, the occult, devil, spiritualism, mesmerism, phrenology, all these kind of fringe things that were going on at the time, as we all have just been talking about. And by using those and inserting those into the story of Dracula, it sort of helps place the novel as a very contemporary novel, but also as a novel that gives us sort of a peek into what were some of those sensibilities during the end of the Victorian era. And these were obviously very sensitive issues to a number of people, and he just hit on them just right. And I think in a way made people uneasy, made them a little bit scared. And as Matt said, and I totally agree, I like things that are scary, but more eerie.
Yes.
And when you think they could be possible, and my gosh, if you're walking down a street and it's foggy and it's dark and you hear something go bump, or you're driving your car as John did and you happen to be thinking of things and you see some dark thing that looks like a monk, by golly, you're going to think of the worst.
Yeah, 100%. No,
you're easy prey, right?
Yeah, exactly. I went to very going to see the Blair Witch Project when it came out, and I like that film. People don't like it. I thought it was quite a good sort of, you know, especially because I lived in a haunted forest. Basically, effectively, my house is built in Red Hall in the haunted forest, and I came back and I got a flat tire outside a place where they used to hang people, and it was dark. I had a flat tire. I just watched the Blair Witch Project. I was freaking out. It's like I've never changed a tire so fast in my entire life.
I've got an interesting ghost story. I don't, perhaps Dacre's not aware of this one, from the Lyceum Theatre, funny enough. I write about it in my latest ghost book, which you can buy, Britain's Haunted Land, plug that again. I don't know how true it is. It sounds pretty weird, but I'll put it out there, because it apparently happened during the time that, you know, Bram was around, and this couple were watching a play. It's sad they didn't say which one. And the woman glanced down and she saw a woman sitting below her, and in her lap was a man's head. And you probably think I'm making this up, but this is what she claimed to have seen. And she pointed it out to her husband, and he didn't believe her. And he looked, and he said, "God, it's a man's head, and it had like a beard and everything." And it was literally in her lap. Now, you know, you could say, "Oh, perhaps she was a bit weird and had some dummy or whatever." But anyway, they during the break they went down to get a closer look, and she covered this head up with a bit of clothing or whatever. So they tried to follow her at the end of the play, and lost her in the crowd. And then a few years later, they were visiting a house in the north of England, and the chap was looking at the portraits on the walls. And sadly, they don't say which house it was. And he saw a portrait. And he said, "God, it's that head. It's the man's head." And it actually turned out that this man had owned the land on which the Lyceum Theatre had been built, and he'd been executed.
Right, well.
So that's a little story. But like I said,
what's the.
Whether that happened or not, I don't know. I wasn't there, but it's interesting. And I just thought it's from the time of Bram being there, you know, it's an interesting little ghost story.
What's the. And you'll know about this more than me, but it's one of the stories I grew up with. It's about. There was quite a well known ghost hunter, we'll say, who went to a house in something like terraced house somewhere in Britain, and there was basically a little girl who was being possessed by an old man in that house. Does it ring a bell? It's like, oh, what was it? There was recordings of his voice. And
sorry, that I know exactly what you mean. I lived in the town where that happened, the Enfield Poltergeist.
That's it, Enfield Poltergeist. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yep, that was a very Guy Playfair did a book on that, and Morris Gross,
that's it. He goes, Morris, yeah.
Yeah, Morris. I lived in Enfield in the 70s, and we talked about that in the schoolyard, and my mum actually used to go down Green Street, so she used to get her hair cut down there, and she spoke to a lollipop lady that swore blind. She glanced up at the house, and she saw the girl, I think it was Janice, floating up and down in front of the window, and this was also seen by a police officer as well. So yeah, it's a very famous case. I've looked into it, and there was definitely, and I know a chap who's got a lot of information on it, and I can't release a lot of it because it's not supposed to be going in the public domain. But there's a lot more to that ghost story than it's been released.
Okay,
and wow. There's definitely something going on there. Definitely, the recordings. I mean, for instance, the girl. They said it was physically impossible for someone to maintain that voice without permanently damaging your voice box, and she could speak like this old man for hours. And it turned out they found out this guy died in that house in the chair as she described. So yeah, very famous. It came out as a book, This House Is Haunted, and I think there was a TV series
it's one of those ones. Growing up as a kid, it was like,
and The Conjuring 2 is based on it as well. Not very accurate, but The Conjuring 2 is about the Enfield Poltergeist. So I lived in the town. My mum used to go past the house, and my daddy worked for Enfield Council for a time. He actually went in the house as a plumber, and nothing happened. But his mate who was there was terrified and wouldn't stay. He legged it, but my dad said no. Sadly, the poltergeist didn't appear. But yeah, very famous case, and the book's still in print. In fact, I'll get a little bit of memorabilia to do with this. I'll just show you the end of the poem.
Okay. It sort of reminds me, like again, I'm very skeptical about these things, but I've got there you go, Green Street. There you go.
Yeah.
Ample
time with the Enfield logo.
Yeah, nice.
Very nice.
Nice.
There you go.
But I'm quite skeptical, but like growing up, there's Red Hall. It's like an old Edwardian mansion house in the middle, and an estate, and obviously our house was within the estate. And they had this like fair thing where you could, like one of the church fairs, and you could go and you could walk around the house and things. And I remember walking around with my friend, and we were in this really freaky room with like dolls and stuff everywhere, and there was this doll, and it was sitting back on the chair, like right in the back. I very vividly remember it was sitting back in the chair, and I turned around and there was a noise, and the doll was not on the chair anymore, and it was on the ground, and I freaked out and ran out of the house and never went back.
Well, as Shakespeare said, there are more things in heaven and earth. So what's your take on ghost day, Kerr? Are you sort of, you know, your views on the supernatural? Are you a sort of skeptic or open-minded or?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I fall pretty much in line with Matt. I would like more information. I would like to believe if I had a little more
Evidence.
evidence, but I do want to be open-minded. You know, as I get older, I begin to think, you know, that there are people that are sensitive to certain things, more open-minded people, maybe more, you know, sensitive to feel, to touch, to thoughts about different energies and so on. And I also default to, you know, that quote by Yeats, and also another one in the novel that Bram wrote, and I think he believes, and I've taken this on, that there are mysteries which men may guess at, which age by age they may solve only in part. And John, you just said one from Hamlet, there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy. That was actually found in the original preface of Dracula, that was in the Icelandic version of Dracula. So I think that sort of sums up what Bram Stoker is telling us. And I didn't inherit that genetically, but I have inherited sort of now more psychologically, because I feel the same way. Boy, there'd be nothing cooler than being able to connect. But I just, you know, maybe I'm more too much of a scientist or a practical type person, you know, sports and the stopwatch and so on. But I would like to, I wish I could experience more if I was able to.
Yeah, exactly that. It's like, you know, I'm a massive nerd. I love magic and dragons and make believe and superpowers and things. So if somebody turned around to me and showed this stuff to me as is existence, it would be something that I'd happily accept it. It's just that me personally have never, I don't think I've experienced enough to justify it. Therefore, I sit in that sort of agnostic sort of like, I was very sort of like, yeah, 100% this doesn't happen. But having that conversation on the podcast sort of made me, okay. You know, there's a lot of things, especially in science, you're always trying to prove new things. And there's something about the ghost particle recently, actually, within a journal about sort of finding it. But if it can be proven to me, I'm open-minded to it. So I'm not going to say no to anything. I'm just going to say I believe this currently, but if it can be proved to me, then I'm happy to sort of accept it. Until that point, I'll just keep my agnostic sort of view on it. I'll just say, okay, I don't believe in it, but I'm open-minded to it.
Well, I mean, science is sort of, discovering things all the time. And who's to say, in 100 years' time, they might say, yeah, we've actually proved it. I mean, in the 18th century, I think it was a French scientific group said, when people said, oh, we've seen stones falling from the sky, and I'm referring to meteorites, not sort of showers of stones like Charles Fort wrote about. And they said, no, it's impossible. Rocks can't fall from the sky. And because eventually it was proved that they could, and you had scientists who said it'd be physically impossible to ever get to the moon, and we got to the moon. And I mean, I often say to people, say about ghosts and that, well, how can you prove they're real? And I said, well, look at radio waves, they're out there, but unless you've got a machine that can sort of pick them up, they're all around us all the time, but we don't know it until we can tap into it, using a computer or radio, things like that.
I
So
think.
I believe there's something. Like I said, I think there's different explanations, but I've just personally, that's just my personal viewpoint. I've met and spoken to too many people in my research and my ghost books who've seen and experienced stuff that can't be explained. I mean, for instance, I had two people told me they saw exactly the same ghost in the same building, described it exactly the same, the clothing, everything, and yet they didn't know of one another. They'd never met, and they weren't aware that this place was haunted, and yet they came back with exactly the same description. So they saw something. I'm not saying it's a ghost. It could have been some recording that, for some reason, the impression that this woman was still there, like a decaying TV picture. But it's just I could give you loads of instances of where people experience stuff that, can't be explained,
Yeah, but if then you've got to look at, like, you know, quantum physics and things like that, that we don't understand at all, and there's a lot sort of things, whereas how we
I
understand.
would interject. We are beginning to understand quantum physics right now.
Okay, well, there's stuff we
Sorry,
still.
I've read a few articles on it.
I appreciate that, but we there's a lot of stuff within sort of that side of things that I would say we don't understand fully. We have this sort of view that we understand this is how physics works now. This is how physics we think physics works on the quantum level, and things don't they don't sort of do what they're meant to do within that level. And then you've got like quirks and all the other stuff. So they're within that realm.
And qubits.
Within that realm, you've got that sort of view that things could potentially happen in certain ways. And so it's funny that you said that you had that sort of like a time echo or something, I think you mentioned earlier, sort of. So that could be something.
A time slip.
Yeah. So something along those lines where you've got sort of, and then there's all the things like parallel universes and all kinds of craziness, like, you know, within that sort of realm of physics. And it's like, so those things could interact with the world and we don't understand it. So it's just sort of, it is what it is. And I think that's, for me, is why I've got an open mind about it. Cause it's like, we don't understand it fully. And, you know, it could be in 100 years' time that, you know, all these things that you've said have happened. You can go, well, this, you know, that is a energy from that person that's come from there, or that's come from that time period, or that's come from there. And, you know, it makes me sad that I might not be around to find out the truth about it. But, yeah, fully open-minded about it.
Yeah. I mean, it's I endorse everything you say. You know, I think that we've got to be open minded and, you know, not accept everything. But I think that the way science is advancing, that, you know, a couple of hundred years from now, you know, we'll probably be shocked if we were still around. You know, what they've discovered, and like you said, parallel universes. I mean, obviously, I first became aware of that watching that classic Star Trek episode, Mirror, Mirror.
Yeah. Spot with me.
You never know, if there is a parallel universe, our alternate selves could be talking about Bram Stoker, but we've all got goatee beards.
Yeah. That stuff like that melts my brain when you talk about sort of parallel universes and things. And like everything you've done, there's obviously somebody who's done something different. And it's like, what would I be doing? Where would I be had I turned left there or I turned right there and done that? It just melts my head. I'm just like...
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it's like they... I mean, look, more and more scientists are coming around to the idea that there are such things as parallel Earths, you know, one where Napoleon won the Battle of Waterloo, one where Hitler won the Second World War, one where we never even existed. The dinosaurs didn't die out and advanced, and lizards are running the planet now and are more intelligent than us. So, yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, Einstein, you know, I mean, the things he came out with, and he even suggested that, you know, time wasn't really how we understood it, you know, hinting that perhaps, you know, time travel was possible. And, you know, the time slips. I mean, you know, there was a chap who saw Roman soldiers in a cellar in York in the 1950s.
Yeah, I heard about that,
Always stuck to his story. And he described them in a way that wasn't accepted by historians at that time because they had green uniforms, round shields. And it turned out his description was right. If he'd been lying, he would have sort of said they sort of look like Charlton Heston, you know, in Ben-Hur. So, and I've spoken to other people. There was a chap in Liverpool who came out of a shop and he was suddenly in the street and everyone was like dressed in 1950s clothing and, you know, old cars and that, and it only lasted a few minutes and then it was gone. Now, did he literally go back in time, or did he for some reason have a vision? But he claimed that someone else witnessed it with him as well. So did he? So yeah, we don't really understand, you know, time and that. So I think, you know, time slips could be very possible. And some ghost stories are probably that, just their time briefly interacting with ours. And they so then we're the ghosts. You know, God, you know, I saw some weird bloke in this futuristic looking vehicle. And who was that, you know?
Yeah, it's just like, it just, for me, it's again, it's just like a, like, being able to understand it. That's the one regret. Like, I don't have a major belief in the afterlife or anything, but for me, it's just like, I just want to know what happens in the future, what we're doing, how humanity sort of evolves and where we go to and things like that. And it's just sort of the fact that I might not be able to see these things just makes me slightly sad.
Yeah, well, I've often said to people in other interviews when they say about your sort of thoughts on the afterlife, I said, well, all I can say is that we'll only find out when it's our time. And I'll either get there and say, my God, it's just as I thought, or I'll get there and say, God, I didn't realise it was like this, or there'll be nothing at all and I won't know about it.
Exactly, yeah, they won't know. Yeah.
So where are you up to in the Indiegogo campaign for Father of Dracula?
Oh, right. Well, we only launched it on Tuesday, so that was April the 2nd. I've been busily sharing it on social media sites, you know, Dracula Vampire sites. Dacre's been doing his bit with podcasts and sharing it, and I'm just going to continue doing that. I contacted the Whitby Gazette, and they put a short piece up about it. The Scarborough News is going to do a little piece. So we're basically just trying to sort of get the message out there as far as we can, you know, with societies, you know, internet groups, anyone who loves Bram Stoker, anyone who's into Dracula, the films, because obviously, I mentioned, you know, the films in as part of the narration and stuff. So, so we're literally, it's the first week of the campaign. It ends on June the 2nd. I think Dacre's got some more podcasts lined up. Obviously, I'm going to try to get some more exposure in the media. So, you know, anything that you guys can do to get it out there, obviously, with this podcast, pass it on to people who are basically interested. You know, we're looking to raise the money. At the moment, we've only had about 3 or 4 pledges. But there again, it's only been going since Tuesday. I did post it on one site, which has got about 30,000 followers. So if only each of them put a pound in, we'll be laughing.
Yeah,
so,
that's, you know, it. Yeah.
But perhaps Dave could be able to sort of say what else he's doing anyways regarding sort of promoting it.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much the strategy is, you know, I have sent things out to print media, and that's always a crapshoot because, you know, if there's an eclipse going on or something political going on, then they like to put those things. So you have to stay at it. You know, it's almost a full-time, full-time job. But I've also, luckily, I do a lot of engagements over the next sort of 2 months where I'll be doing speaking or being at conventions, and I'll be passing out little cards about it and talking about it in my chats, other than like John said, doing podcasts, because, you know, hopefully people would want to be interested enough to get an idea. You know, as I always joke about it, saying the creation has overshadowed the creator. Let's now we got a time to see who this creator was. Well, and yeah, get to know who this guy really was. And you've heard a lot about John's passion about the supernatural. And that was obviously one of Bram's gigs. So, yeah, I think you're going to be really impressed. And Figgis has a track record. John can tell you more off the top of his head, but it's out there on the Indiegogo page about all the things John does. One in particular that I was really impressed with when I first met him was his documentary on Sir Simon Marsden, who is a great photographer, and it was very Victorian, ghosty era type stuff. I loved it. And that's what I said to him, look, if you're ever interested in doing something Dracula, he said, that's the theme I'm looking for. And he goes, absolutely, me too. So he's got a good track record of doing film and getting lots of awards for it. And between John and I, you can be pretty much trusted you're going to get a good, faithful script, interesting. And since I narrated it, I can say I think it's pretty good job narrating as well.
And what time Scott, are you thinking of for its release?
Is that for me or for Dacre?
Yes,
it better be for you because you're on that end of things, John. I have no idea. Once Figgis gets his money
we're looking at this year. I mean, obviously the campaign ends on June the 2nd, and obviously we're both going to carry on promoting it, and this great Dacre is going to be sort of doing his talks and raising it, and hopefully we get a few pledges. I mean, the cheapest pledge on there is only £10, which is $1,000. So, but I mean, there's like a 500, I think, you know, there's 1,000 as well, the top one. But I mean, even if if we got 1,000 people, you know, pledging £10, I mean, it soon adds up. So yeah, so we're looking to get it made this year, definitely. As Dacre said, you know, Jason's a great director, editor, and it was a Simon Marsden documentary which I appear in that brought me and Jason together. That's how we met, because I'd been reading Simon's books from when I was, oh god, the 80s, you know, when I was in my early 20s. So yeah, and we've done other stuff together. We're working on a documentary about Poltergeist. I was in The Ghost of Winifred Meeks that Jason wrote and directed. I played the landlord, and my girlfriend at the time played the ghost. So we're not together anymore. The moral of that story is never date a ghost, because it don't work out. Yeah. But yeah, anyway, it's definitely going to be made. Definitely going to be made. And if Julie Abbott's watching, hello.
Yeah. You've got I'm just looking at you. You've got a lot of options here. I've just shown it on the screen. You know, anything from £10 all the way up to £1,000, with sort of in betweens being £35 for a first look, and then the film for £50.
Yeah.
And looking at Figgis, Jason Figgis is an award-winning IFTA-nominated film and TV director. He's done Sky One, Sky Arts, Channel 4, Hulu, RTE, Apple Plus, iTunes, KSM, SVT. He's got, he's got a lot. Discovery Channel, Amazon, Lionsgate Studios. So, yeah, he's definitely got the experience.
Yeah, he did a documentary with Uri Geller, which I think is on YouTube now, about Haunted Venice.
Oh, right, okay.
And he's done. We did some short films together, and we did Maverick, which is about the King's Head Theatre in London. He did a new version of that with people like Richard E. Grant, Victoria Wood are in it. So I should mention there's an actress, Gemma Gordon, who appears in the documentary. I think she's playing... is she playing now, Dave? Was it Mina?
I think it was Mina, yeah.
Yeah, so she's in it as well. I better mention that because she might come after me and pump me. But yeah, she's very good. She's reading extracts from the letters and the diaries as well. So she's in it. So it's going to be a really great documentary. Dave did a great job narrating it, providing fantastic material, which is going to surprise people and perhaps shock them as well. With a great director, great visuals and things like that. And Dake has also provided tons of illustrations, contemporary stuff. So it's going to be, you know, a really good documentary. And it's definitely going to be made this side of Christmas anyway. But fingers crossed we get a few bob, because obviously it'd be nice if all of us were paid. Because, you know, I did a writing, Dake did a great narration, a lot of research. And obviously Jason's going to direct and edit it. So we could do with a few thousand pounds.
Well, good luck. Yeah. It sounds amazing. You've got a pledge from me. I'm definitely interested. So yeah, you've got a pledge. Sold. Done.
Thank you.
I will be showing it on the Geek Pride channels for all our listeners who want to donate to it. We will be showing it on the channel after the podcast.
Yes, we will.
Brilliant. And if you make the top, I think it's one of the top pledges, you get the signed script from me, Dacre, and Jason. And also, if you make the top pledge, you get a free copy of my book signed as well. There's lots of goodies there. There's a soundtrack, there's a portrait of Bram by, I think it's of Bram, or is it Dracula? Anyway, by Jason. So there's loads and loads of goodies. There's be stills, obviously a copy of the documentary. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, the cheapest one's the equivalent of £10, which is nothing. I mean, it's not even a meal, is it? So pledge away, please. And if there's a few that want to pledge a thousand, me and Dacre and Jason aren't going to complain.
Absolutely.
I could do with the money, I tell you.
Amazing. Okay, well, is there anything you gentlemen want to plug, talk about before we leave for tonight? Is there anything else you would like to mention?
I've got a website. People can check me out on there, johnwestmedia.com. I write for Psychic News magazine. That's out every month. Ghost stories, you can get it from, you know, news agents, order it direct from the publisher. The ghost books are out there. They're all on Amazon. Britain's Haunted Land's the latest one. You can follow me on X. I'm on there. I'm on Instagram and on Facebook. So, at the moment, the project I'm working on is Poltergeist as well, a documentary about what they possibly are. And we've got Alan Murdy from the Ghost Club has provided a lot of research material, and he'll be appearing in it. And there's various other projects that are sort of lined up with Jason. And with the Dracula one, just really looking forward to getting it out there. And hopefully once it's made, we'll get it screened at various film festivals. And perhaps put it in for the Bram Stoker. I think, is it a Bram Stoker film award, Dacre? There's something, isn't there, to do with him that we could put it in for and get an award or something?
Well, yeah, there's the Bram Stoker Festival in Dublin, and also the Horror Writers Association now has a film category in America. So that would be cool to have a Bram Stoker award for that.
Well, brilliant. And perhaps, Dacre, you could have a word with the President of the United States and get him to make a pledge. Because if he's a fan of Bram Stoker and Dracula, we could do with the money. Or even Donald Trump, if he wants to.
Oh,
donate.
Lord. God.
You've got that nonsense
coming up soon, don't you? In the next 5 months. What is it, November?
Oh,
is your next election November?
Yeah.
Well, I'll just for the record, I am Canadian, although I live here under a green card, so I don't have the right to vote, but I sit back and get very amused by the whole situation.
Oh yeah, man, it's car crash TV. Like I love it. I just sit there and just
and
like,
then you look at our politics, yeah, Matt.
I know, but it just makes like. No, I'm not even going to go down that line, but it's just like...
Matt, have you had your turn to be Prime Minister? Because I think mine's coming up.
Mine's coming up in November, October, I believe.
On that note, guys, thank you all very much. Another horror show. Okay, guys. Very good. Okay.
But yeah, there you go. You've got another backer now. I just dialed it in. You have a back. I'm really looking forward to seeing it. It sounds really interesting. Again, I really appreciate your time. I hope people who are watching, there's been a fair few watching currently, by all means, please check out the Indiegogo. It's Father of Dracula on Indiegogo. You can Google it. It will show up there. Give it a back. It sounds like it'll be a really interesting watch. So I can't wait for it to drop. Yeah. Anything else, gentlemen, before we go?
No, and the stake wants to say something. I'm fine. I've enjoyed it.
No, I'll just say this. Like John, follow me on Facebook, Instagram, Dacre Stoker, Arthur, DacreStoker.com, BramStokerEstate.com. And if you really want a thrill, I work with a company called Experience Transylvania and Stoker Wines, which is a whole nother story, in Romania. And we're hosting a party on October the 28th, just before Halloween, in Bran Castle in Transylvania.
Oh, nice, nice.
Brilliant. I do not drink wine.
Absolutely. We're about to start publicizing that and inviting people to come and join us.
We have a Romanian writer, actually. Well, I have to ask her. She wants to, Christina, we'll see if she can bob along. But yeah, okay, cool. Right, that's
and really... don't forget about your books, Dacre, as well, because you've written a few books.
Sure, Dracula the Undead, a sequel to Dracula, and Dracul, a prequel to Dracula. Both of those are international bestsellers. So if you're interested in before or after Dracula, those have come pretty recommended and both of them bestsellers. So yeah, jump on board if you're interested in how the story started or how it finished after 25 years after the novel ended.
Nice, nice. Right. Being really interesting. I feel like we could talk about history and ghosts and Dracula for a lot longer, but unfortunately I've got a bail. But really appreciate your time, gents. Good luck with the Indiegogo. I hope I hope you blast it out of the water. So good
Thank
luck. For me tonight, I've been Matt Gary. With me has been Peter Ray Allison.
Good night, everyone.
And our special guest, John West.
Thank you.
And Dacre Stoker.
Hi, guys.